The old warrior Hilto came swiftly to Taita's summons. He'd been waiting in the guardroom at the palace gates. With him, he brought the Nubian shaman, Bay, and four of his most trusted men. One of these was Meron, the friend and companion of Nefer's childhood. He was now a handsome ensign of the guards, tall of stature and clear of eye. Taita had asked for him particularly to take part in these duties. Between them, they carried the long woven basket that the embalmers used to transport their cadavers to the funerary temple. The empty basket seemed heavier than one might have expected. Taita led them into the death chamber and whispered to Hilto, "Swiftly now, every second is precious." He had already wrapped Nefer in the long white winding sheet, with a loose fold of linen covering his face. The pallbearers laid the basket beside the couch and lifted Nefer reverently into it. Taita packed bolsters around the body to cushion it during the move, then closed the lid and nodded. "To the temple," he said. "All is in readiness." Taita trusted his bag to Meron, and they moved quickly through the passages and corridors of the palace. The sound of mourning and lamentation followed them. The guards lowered the points of their weapons and knelt as the dead pharaoh passed. The women covered their faces and wailed. All the lamps had been extinguished, and the fires in the kitchen had been drawn so that no smoke rose from the chimneys. In the entrance courtyard, a squadron of Hilto's chariots was drawn up with horses in the traces. The bearers laid the long basket on the footplate of the leading chariot and secured it with leather straps. Meron placed Taita's leather instrument bag in the cockpit, and Taita mounted and took the reins. The ram's horns of the regiment sounded a dirge, and the column moved out through the gates at a walk. The news of Pharaoh's death had spread through the city like the plague. The citizens crowded around the gates, wailing and ululating as the column passed. Crowds lined the route along the river. Women, howling their grief, ran forward and threw the sacred lotus blossoms onto the basket. Taita pushed the horses into a trot, then into a canter. He was desperate to get the basket into the sanctuary of the funerary temple. The temple of Nefer's father had not been demolished, even though Pharaoh Tamozer had been taken months ago to his tomb in the bleak hills to the west. No temple had yet been built for Nefer. He was so young that the expectation of his life stretched far ahead of him. His death now was untimely, and left them no alternative but to use the building prepared for his father. The tall, rose-coloured granite walls and portico of the temple were set upon a low prominence overlooking the Green River. The priests, hastily assembled, were waiting to greet the column. Their heads were freshly shaven and anointed with oil. The drums and sistrum beat a slow tempo as Taita drove up the wide causeway and halted the chariot at the foot of the staircase that mounted to the Hall of Sorrow. Hilto and his warriors lifted the basket and climbed the staircase with it balanced on their shoulders. The priests fell in behind them, singing mournfully. Before the open wooden doors of the Hall of Sorrow, the pallbearers paused, and Taita looked back at the priests. "By the grace and authority of the Regent of Egypt, I, Taita, have been charged with lifting Pharaoh's viscera." He fixed the high priest with a mesmeric gaze. "All others will wait without while I perform this sacred charge." There was a hum of consternation among the Brotherhood of Anubis. This was a solecism against tradition and their own authority. But Taita held the priest's eye sternly, then slowly lifted his right hand, holding the periapt of Lostris. The priest knew by fearful repute the power of that relic. "As the regent of Egypt has decreed," he capitulated, "we will pray without, while the Magus performs his duty." Taita led Hilto and the bearers through the doorway, and they solemnly laid the basket on the floor beside the black diorite slab in the centre of the Hall of Sorrow. Taita glanced at Hilto, and the grizzled old commander marched to the doors with great dignity and shut them in the faces of the assembled priests. Then he hurried back to Taita's side. Between them they opened the basket and lifted out Nefer's wrapped body. They laid it on the black slab. Taita turned back the fold of cloth that covered Nefer's face. He looked pale and lovely as an ivory carving of the young god Horus. Gently, Taita turned his head to one side and nodded at Bay, who placed the leather instrument bag close to his right hand and opened it. Taita selected the ivory forceps, slipped the points into Nefer's ear, and drew out the woolen plug. He filled his own mouth with dark, ruby-coloured liquid from a glass jar, and through a gold tube carefully sluiced the dregs of the elixir of Anubis from Nefer's eardrums. When he looked deep into the ear passages, he was relieved to see that there was no inflammation. Next, he introduced a soothing ointment into the ear orifices and replugged them. Bay had the antidote to the elixir ready in another phial. When he opened the stopper, it released a sharp odour of camphor and sulphur. Hilto helped them to lift Nefer into a sitting position, and Taita administered the entire contents of the phial. Merrin and the others had been watching this with blank incomprehension. Suddenly, Nefer coughed harshly, and with superstitious dread they sprang back from the slab and made the sign against evil. Taita massaged Nefer's bare back, and he coughed again, vomiting a little yellow bile. While Taita kept working steadily at reviving him, Hilto ordered his men to their knees and made them swear a dreadful oath of secrecy as to all that they were witnessing. Shaking and pale, they swore their lives into jeopardy. Taita placed his ear to Nefer's back, listened for a while, then nodded. He massaged him again and listened once more. He signed to Bay, who took a twist of dried herbs from the bag and lit the end at one of the temple lamps. He held it under Nefer's nose. The boy sneezed and tried to turn his head away. Satisfied at last, Taita re-wrapped him in the linen sheet and made another sign to Bay and Hilto. The three turned back to the basket. The others gaped as Taita lifted out the false bottom and revealed another corpse laid in the compartment beneath. This body was also wrapped in a white linen winding sheet. "Come," Hilto ordered. "Lift it out." Under Taita's sharp eye and Hilto's stern instruction, they exchanged the two bodies. They lay Nefer in the hidden compartment in the bottom of the basket, but did not yet replace the false bottom. Bay squatted beside the basket to watch Nefer and to check his condition. The others laid the strange corpse on the diorite slab. Taita swept away the winding sheet and revealed the body of a youth of about the same age and bodily shape of Nefer. He had the same thick, dark hair. It had been Hilto's responsibility to procure this corpse. In the present climate in the land, this had not been difficult. The plague was still flourishing in the poorer outlying areas of the Nome. In addition, there were the nightly gleanings from the streets and alleys of the city, the victims of brawling, outright murder, or footpads. Hilto had considered all these sources. However, in the end he had found, in circumstances so perfect of the quest that they could not have been coincidental, the ideal subject for the young pharaoh. The city bailiffs had arrested this lad in the very act of slitting the purse of one of the most influential millet merchants in Thebes, and the magistrates had not hesitated in sentencing him to death by strangulation. The condemned lad was so like in body and general complexion to Nefer as to be able to pass as his brother. In addition, he was well set up and healthy, not like the starvelings and plague victims. Hilto had spoken to the commander of the city guards, who had been charged with carrying out the execution. And during this friendly exchange, three heavy gold rings had found their way into that worthy's purse. It was agreed that the strangulation be delayed until Hilto gave him the word, and that it would be carried out with as little apparent damage to the victim as the executioner's skill could encompass. The prisoner had been given justice that very morning, and his body was not yet cold. The canopic jars were arranged in the small shrine at the end of the hall. Taita ordered Merrin to fetch them and open the stoppers ready for filling. While he was doing this, Taita rolled the corpse over and made a sweeping incision down his left side. There was little time for surgical finesse. He thrust his hand into the opening and drew forth the viscera, then, using both hands, he worked the scalpel deep into the interior of the corpse. First he cut through the diaphragm to gain access to the chest cavity, then reached deeper past the lungs, liver and spleen, until he could sever the windpipe above its juncture with the lungs. Finally he rolled the corpse over, ordered Merrin to hold the buttocks apart, and with sure strokes freed the sphincter muscles of the anus. Now all the contents of the interior of the chest and abdomen were unanchored. He brought them out onto the diorite slab in a single mass. Merrin blanched, swayed on his feet, and clapped his hand over his mouth. "Not on the floor, in the sink," Taita ordered brusquely. Merrin had fought against a Pepe's regiments in the north. He'd killed a man and been unaffected by the carnage of the battlefield. But now he fled to the stone basin in the corner and puked noisily into it. Bloodied to the elbows, Taita began to separate the liver, lungs, stomach, and entrails into piles. As soon as this was done, he took the entrails and stomach to the sink, wherein already reposed Merrin's contribution. He flushed out the contents of the dismembered stomach and entrails and packed them into the jars. He filled every jar with the pickling natron salts and sealed the stoppers. Then he washed his hands and arms in the bronze basins filled with water expressly for that purpose. He glanced inquiringly at Bay, and the Nubian nodded his bald, scarified head, reassuring Taita as to Nefer's condition. Working with controlled haste, Taita stitched the abdominal incision closed. Then he bandaged the head until its features were hidden. When that was done, he and Hilto carried the corpse to the large natron bath and lowered it into the harsh alkali mixture until only the bandaged head was not immersed. It would remain in the bath, with the head covered, for the next 60 days. At the end of that time, the priest would remove the bandage and discover the substitution. By that time, however, Taita and Nefer would be far away. It took only a little longer to sluice down the slab with leather buckets of water and to pack Taita's instruments before they were ready to leave. Taita knelt beside the basket in which Nefer lay and laid a hand on his naked chest to feel the warmth of his skin and to check his breathing. It was slow and even. He drew down one eyelid and watched the pupil react to the light. Satisfied, he stood up and gestured for Hilto and Bay to cover the hidden compartment. When this was done, and they began to replace the basket lid, Taita stopped them. "Leave it open," he ordered. "Let the priests see that it is empty." The bearers lifted the basket by its handles, and Taita led them to the doors. As they approached, Hilto threw them open, and the assembly of priests craned forward. They gave the empty basket only a cursory glance as it was carried out, then rushed into the Hall of Sorrow with almost indecent haste to take over the duties that had been usurped from them. Ignored by the crowds that had gathered outside the temple, Taita's men loaded the basket onto the leading chariot and drove in column back to the city. When they entered the main gates, they found the narrow streets almost deserted. The populace had either flocked to the funerary temple to pray for the young pharaoh, or they had hurried to the palace to await the announcement of his successor, although there was little doubt in anyone's mind as to who would be the next pharaoh of the Upper Kingdom. Hilto drove the chariot to the guards' barracks near the east gate, and the basket was carried through the back entrance of his private quarters. Here everything was in readiness to receive Nefer. They lifted him out of the bottom compartment, and Taita, with Bay assisting him, went to work to revive Nefer fully. Within hours he was well enough to eat a little millet bread and drink a bowl of warm mare's milk and honey. At last, Taita judged it safe to leave him for a while in Bay's charge and drove through the narrow, empty streets. Ahead of him he heard the sudden din of wild cheering. When he reached the environs of the palace, he found himself enveloped in a dense crowd of citizens celebrating the ascension of the new pharaoh. Eternal life to his sacred majesty, Pharaoh Naja Kiafan! They howled with loyal fervour and passed the wine jugs from hand to hand. So thick were the crowds that Taitu was forced to leave the chariot with Merin and go the rest of the way on foot. At the palace gate the guards recognised him and used the butts of their spears to clear the way for him to pass. Once he was in the grounds, he hurried to the great hall, and there found another press of obsequious humanity. All the military officers, courtiers, and state dignitaries were waiting to swear loyalty and fealty to the new pharaoh. But Taita's reputation and his unnerving gaze ensured that the crowd made way for him to pass to the front ranks. Pharaoh Naja Kiafan and his queen were in the private cabinet beyond the doors at the end of the hall, but Taita had to wait only a short while before he was granted access to the royal presence. To his astonishment, he found that Naja was already wearing a double crown and holding the flail and crook crossed over his chest. Beside him, Queen Heseret seemed to have blossomed like the desert rose under the caress of rain. She was as lovely as Taita had ever known her, pale and serene under her makeup, her eyes made enormous by skilfully applied kohl. When Taita entered, Naja dismissed those around him, and soon the three were alone. This in itself was a sign of high favour. Then Naja laid aside the flail and the crook, and came to embrace Taita.
"Magus, I should never have doubted you," he said, his voice even more sonorous and commanding than before. "You have earned my gratitude."
He took from his right hand a magnificent ring of gold and ruby and placed it on Taita's right index finger.
"This is but a small token of my favour."
Taita wondered that he'd placed such a powerful talisman in his hands. Only a lock of Naja's hair or the clippings of his nails would have been more potent. Heseret came forward and kissed him.
"Dearest Taita, you have always been faithful to my family. You shall have gold, land, and influence beyond anything you have ever coveted."
After all these years, she knew so little of him.
"Your generosity is exceeded only by your beauty," he said, and she simpered. Then he turned back to Naja. "I have done what the gods required of me, your grace, but it has cost me dear. It is not a light or easy matter to go against my sense of duty and the dictates of my own heart. You know that I loved Nefer. Now I owe you that same duty and love. But for a space I must mourn Nefer and make my peace with his shade."
"It would be strange indeed if you did not feel for the dead pharaoh," Naja agreed. "What do you wish of me, Magus? Only to speak the words."
"Your grace, I ask your dispensation to go into the desert, to be alone for a time."
"How long?" Naja asked, and Taita could see he was alarmed by the thought of losing the key to eternal life, which he truly believed Taita held in his hands.
"Not too long, Majesty," Taita assured him.
Naja thought about it for a while. He was never a man for hasty decisions. At last he sighed and went to the low table upon which stood stylus and papyrus. Swiftly he wrote out a safe pass and sealed it with his royal cartouche. It was clear that the seal had been carved long ago, in anticipation of his succession. While Naja waited for the ink to dry, he said, "You may absent yourself until the next inundation of the Nile begins, but then you must return to me. This safe conduct will allow you to travel at large, and avail yourself of whatever food and equipment you may need from my royal storehouses, anywhere in my domains." Taita prostrated himself in gratitude, but Naja lifted him to his feet in another extraordinary act of condescension.
Go, Magus, and return to us on the appointed day to receive the rewards you so richly deserve. Clutching the roll of papyrus, Taita backed towards the door, making the signs of blessing and benediction.